which is an old subject, goes back to Rayleigh and all the early people, and I at least has taught me new tricks. And so I'll talk about really four different subjects. A lot of it is the work of Kwangji Wu, Stacy Wise, Demetrio's students in my group have worked on this. And so let me go through a quick outline. So I'm going to give you sort of four talks, four 10-minute talks in search of a common theme, if you like. And the first is the idea of making white light, broadband optical resonators using diffraction. And what our assumption was, the diffraction of light affects optical path only because it steers the beam, and that assumption turned out to be wrong. I'm going to talk about enhanced transmission of light by sub-wavelength Hall arrays. Our assumption in thinking about this is that if the size is smaller than the wavelength, physical optics says no light comes through, and I'm going to tell you that that's wrong. I'm going to talk about briefly about beaming of light by structures around a single hole, and our assumption, slightly more sophisticated than the second one, that a small hole diffracts the light into a 2-pi dome behind the diffracting object, and that's going to turn out to be false for these structures. And then finally, I'll talk about imaging by photon sieves, by an array of holes on a metal film. And usually you think that to make a picture, to make an image, which was on the first slide, you need curved surfaces and lenses, but you don't. You can do it with a bunch of holes. So white light cavities, and this is built on a femtosecond laser device called a pulse compressor expander, two parallel gratings, and the idea was we could use that to increase the bandwidth of a cavity. And it turned out it didn't work at all. It's as if the gratings weren't there, and we took a little time to understand it. And the idea was this was a device we might use in a gravitational wave detector. So I'll touch for one slide on LIGO gravitational wave detectors. So what's the pulse compressor or expander? You come in with a beam of light with some bandwidth. I've got red, green, and blue here. It strikes a grating. The grating equation says that the long wavelength, alpha is the incident angle constant, beta, if lambda gets bigger, beta gets bigger, and so the red light is diffracted more than the green light, which is diffracted more than the blue light. And then they hit a second identical grating at the same angle. Now beta is the incident angle and alpha is the diffraction angle, and so all three beams go off parallel. And the femtosecond laser jockeys use this to then go through some spatial light modulator, phase shifters and stuff to tune up their pulses, and it works fine for them. So let's put mirrors at each end here. So we put a mirror here, it's converging to give the cavity some stability, and a mirror here, put the waste of the system down here, and you can see manifestly that the red light has gone farther than the green light, which has gone farther than the blue light, but it's putting a ruler on this drawing. And so what we wanted to do was adjust the spacing and the overall length such that the red, the green, and the blue all had the same number of wavelengths in this cavity, so the same optical phase on passing back and forth in the cavity. And you can do that for a limited band as long as you can linearize the sign around its middle value. That works. And so you could calculate then that you could make all three wavelengths resonate in a high finesse cavity rather than perhaps only one, only a series. And were this true, you could incorporate these gratings into the arms of a kilometer scale gravitational wave detector, which has resonant cavities in both arms to increase the effective path length, and you could broaden. The problem is that if you turn up the finesse, you get more passes back and forth through this cavity, but the gain bandwidth product tells you that you increase the gain, you narrow the bandwidth, and you lose sensitivity or you lose your ability to measure over a wide range. And sure enough, a calculation based on some optimization of the cavity lengths and the grating angles and so forth, we can get maybe 5 orders of magnitude improvement. So it's really true in spades, and you could get better high frequency performance, or you could turn the phase up, turn the finesse up, and get better better sensitivity. Oh, I didn't want to do that. I guess I wanted to do that, yeah. And the experiment said, we tried it, measured the bandwidth in a short cavity on a table, and we saw no change whatsoever, whether the gratings were there or they were just replaced with two mirrors, and we measured them by scanning a laser through the cavity. And the reason is the cavities bestow a phase factor on the light diffracted from them. So it doesn't just change the direction of the ray. Each grating slit interferes constructively with the neighboring slit with a phase of 2 pi in first order. And that's what you add up to get the fact that the multiple slit diffraction all sends the light in the same direction. And so there's the phase, and in the end, there's a linear shift, just the shift theorem in Fourier analysis, that if you shift the origin by x naught, you get a linear coefficient in the phase, 2 pi, g is 2 pi over the grating constant. And so Yanbei Chen, who's a very smart theorist, figured this out overnight when we told him that it wasn't working. And so the phase then has this linear shift in it, linear in the displacement. So of course we were told this, but we didn't believe it, so we went and tried an experiment. So here's the experiment. This is a Mach-Zehnder interferometer. We come in with a laser to a beam splitter. One beam goes out to this one where the beams will recombine, and then we measure. The other half of the light goes through, hits these two gratings, come back, and go to the photodiode. And of course, there'll be interference here, sinusoidal interference, as the relative path lengths in these two arms change. And then we put one of the two gratings on a stage, and we can move it parallel to its surface and perpendicular to its surface. Parallel to its surface, in principle, our idea was nothing would happen. All we're doing is moving an effectively plane surface parallel to its surface, and how can that change anything? Perpendicular to its surface, we're shortening this path and this path, and we expect to see fringes. There's a little bit of a misalignment, of course. That's what this angle theta is between the surface of the grating and the XY components of the motion. But that's pretty small in these measurements, so we can ignore that. And so let's look at the results. Perpendicular motion, we expect to see fringes. Here they are. We're moving along Y, the separation normal to the gratings. And sure enough, large fringes, almost zero signal at the dark fringe and some relatively bright, good signal to noise. And the period is basically the wavelength. So that's what you expect. So now let's look at when parallel to the surface. We see large fringes, dark fringes almost zero, good signal to noise, almost the same amplitude. We're sliding this grating parallel to its surface. Now, of course, if you think in ray optics, you're wandering up and down the slots on the grating or the corrugations on the grating, but you have a beam that is interrogating thousands of lines, because if you don't put the beam over thousands of lines of the grating, you get no high-resolution diffraction, which is what we want. So, in fact, we're moving plane waves, in effect, across a corrugated surface, and on average, that should average out, but you can see you have a big effect. And so the phase that Yanbei predicted, the phase is D, should be D, the grating constant. So what we learned from this was that our idea was wrong. We can't violate the sort of gain bandwidth theorem that if you increase the gain of a system, you need to narrow the bandwidth and vice versa. And so the phase of light diffracted from a grating cannot be deduced from the diffraction equation and geometry alone. And there's this absolute phase which depends on the relative motion of the beam on the face of the grating. So that's a problem for many implications of if you're putting optics in a very quiet system, diffractive optics, you have to worry about all the vibrational motion, not just the normal to the surface. All degrees of freedom matter. So let me now turn to 10-minute talk number two, enhanced transmission. It's probably the largest thing I want to spend the most time on. We want to look at periodic, some period d sub g, sub-wavelength holes. It means the size of the hole is going to be smaller than the wavelength. And it's been known since 1998 that you get a large in transmission at certain wavelengths from these hole arrays. So, for instance, you have a 25% of your metal film is hole, by just the size of the holes, the open area fraction, and you can get up to 75% of the light through. Now, geometric optics, ray tracing, would tell you you get 25% through, 25% open holes. And physical optics says a much smaller number. But this is an interesting thing. And this has led to a minor field of optics called plasmonics that you could control light and do electronics with plasmon, surface plasmon, polaritons, it's sometimes called. And the wave vector of the surface plasmon plus 2 pi time over the wavelength, which is a wave vector of the light, matches the light, and you can perhaps generate these. And there are really sort of two competing explanations. One is this, it's all surface plasmon, so you need plasma, so you need a metal. Another one proposed by a number of people working in the field is coherent, diffracted, evanescent waves. In both cases, it really relies on diffraction, on this Bragg equation or diffraction equation. This is scalar diffraction and coherent addition at holes. What we show is there's scaling. So if you change the gradient constant in the hole size, the effect scales in wavelength by that factor. Double the size, you double the wavelength at which you see anything. The dielectric function changes a lot if you change the wavelength a lot of the same metal. And so I think neither of these pictures is really true. And we also show that you need to do vector, whatever theory you do, because we'll show some anisotropy with electric field polarization. So this is Ebbesen's experiment. He made little holes in a silver film. Period was 900 nanometers, open area fractionally about 2%. And he saw at a peak here 4% transmission at 1,500 nanometers, which is 10 times the size of the hole. Now, this actually turns out to be an effect of light in the glass substrate, so you should divide this 1,500 by square root of 2, which is the refractive index of fused silica, 1.4. So it's about 1 micron wavelength in the glass that he's seeing. And then there's a dip and another peak and a dip and so forth and so on. Okay, so we were interested in this, so we made some of these. The surface plasmon idea is this is the wave vector of the surface plasmon. It depends on the dielectric function of the vacuum around it and of the metal. And so because the vacuum is the material in which the wave is propagating, and it's an evanescent wave that runs on the surface of the film. And if I have a free surface, a completely flat, planar surface, then I can write the dispersion relation, the frequency versus wave vector of the surface plasmon, of the surface wave in the metal, and the wave in free space, and those two waves don't cross. And so there's no coupling. If you bounce light off a metal, you get specular reflection, and you don't generate these evanescent waves because there's no way you can conserve energy and momentum on the interaction. And so what you have to do is put a periodic grating on there, and then you can use that wave vector, 2 pi over the grating constant, to make another line for the scattered photon, which involves interacting with a periodic dielectric function on the surface, and now you have a crossing where you would interact. And that depends on the angle of incidence and the grating constant. Now, what's never explained in any of the theories I've seen, except for this one that I'm going to talk about from Florida by Shabanov, is how you can generate surface plasmons on this side. How do you get the energy through to the back? If you had surface plasmons on the back, surface waves, they would Bragg scatter, diffract from this periodic structure, and emit photons into the vacuum again. And there's sort of magic has to occur between the top and the bottom. They have to be coupled. And it's about 100 nanometers of metal, so it's thicker than the mean free path of the conduction electrons, at least in the metal. Composite diffractive evanescent waves sort of does the same thing. It adds up scattering vectors from all the holes, looks at them at a single hole, does put in the attenuation of waves falling on the surface, and then gets again a crossing between frequency and wave vector where they think they're going out. But again, there's not much discussion of how the light gets from top to bottom. So let's look at some samples. This is a scanning electron microscope of a silver film with square holes in it. They have a spacing of about 2 microns, and they're about 0.9 micron in size. So they're about 20% open area, and they're on 150 nanometer film. And my colleague Art Hebbard makes beautiful silver film, so that it has a good electrical resistivity, and we know it's pretty much silver's dielectric function. We did a little bit of work I won't show on rectangles and slits, and we tried to put dots in the middle. We were thinking we'd make a coax waveguide between the top and the bottom. That didn't help. And then we make a reference so we can measure the transmission with a hole that circumscribes the pattern. And then I'll show you some transmission curves. So this is 20% open area. So this dashed line is the geometric optics prediction. And this first peak, what you always see is the sort of asymmetric peak from long wavelengths where this cysta pattern is opaque. It's as if the holes weren't there and it was just metal. And then there's a dip. This dip corresponds to the Bragg diffraction of the waves traveling in the substrate material, which in this case is glass. Second peak, second dip, more structure. This is the bulk plasma frequency of silver. So this peak is the fact that silver is becoming transparent in the ultraviolet just before the D transitions cut on. And so that depends a bit on the thickness, but it's 0.5% in this thin film. But you can see we got 2 or 3 times the geometric. Our best samples sort of this type reach up to about 80%. If I think of what should I get from really physical optics, forget this geometric optic stuff, we know that's wrong. If I calculate the transmission by hole, I go back to an equation by Hans Bethe in the 30s, and he calculated the transmission of an isolated hole in the long wavelength limit. It's only when that's true. And it goes as the diameter radius over lambda to the 4th power. So it's a big, it's just scattering, the same thing you get for scattering from spheres of dust or molecules in the sky. So 1/4 lambda to the 4th. And so this is a small factor. It's a factor of 18. So here's Bethe's curve, and we carry it up out to, we get about 1% we get to 1 for the normalized transmission. And so if all the holes were incoherent, we should get this curve, just adding their intensities. So the effect is a coherent or superposition because we have periodic rays. We can sit down and believe the surface plasma on a theory, and we predict the peak locations incorrectly. Not too incorrectly, but it's because the peaks and the dips are not too widely separated in this calculation, and the dips are gotten right. So there's a calculation for the wavelength of the maximum. Depends on the dielectric function of the glass and the metal and the grating constant, and then a set of indices, I and J, which are the order of diffraction in the X and Y directions. The dips, as I say, work out well because this is just Bragg's formula. It's N lambda is D sine theta, except we have 2 indices for the orders. Here's the grating constant, and then here's the refractive index that determines the wavelength that's striking the grating. And you can see the dips are well predicted because it's just diffraction. So we wanted to investigate this more, so we went out to the infrared and we put silver on zinc selenide and we measured these transmissions. So we have grating constants of 4, 6, and 8 microns, and we have open area fractions of 44%, 25%, and 10%. And in first order, to me anyway, all those curves look basically identical. There's a peak, there's an asymmetric wing to the high wavelength side or low frequency side, a dip, a second peak, and so forth. And in fact, these features scale. So we scale by this lambda sub s, a scaling wavelength, which is the wavelength divided by the refractive index. It's different for quartz and zinc selenide, and the grating constant. So here's two samples with 1 and 2 micron grading constants on Fusilica, and here's 3 samples with 4, 8, and that should be 4, 6, and 8. At 8 microns, this dip is out at about 20 microns, and the dielectric constant of silver is minus 14,000 at that wavelength. At 1 micron, the dip is, with a 1 micron spacing, the dip is at about 1.4 microns, and the dielectric constant is 90. So it's changed by a large factor, but yet the scaling goes pretty well. I say it's the experiment, not the idea, that it makes for the difference. So let me talk a little bit about trapped modes. This is a theory by Shabanov and his colleague. It's a resonant in the idea is that some of the electromagnetic energy becomes resonant in the holes. And how much is resonant and what the energy distribution depends on the hole size. So this is a calculation for a 44% open area. This is a calculation for 11%. This is 1 unit cell in black. So this structure is periodic with this being 1 unit cell. And this is a small hole and this is a big hole. On the big hole, it looks capacitive. You basically are charging energy on either side of the hole. For a small hole, it's more as if there are currents flowing, inductive induced currents from the AC-RF field. And he can calculate, what he like to calculate is the absorption, the sum of the transmission and the reflection for these various things. And you get a dip, which means a maximum in absorption, just at the long wavelength side of this one, which is our scaling wavelength, or the diffraction threshold, the longest wavelength diffraction threshold. But he can calculate the transmission as well. And here's a comparison of experiment and theory. That's not great, but the theory shows the observed broadening and decrease on the high frequency side of this dip as we go from small holes to big holes. So we're reasonably happy with this agreement. And the nice thing about the trap mode theory is it actually tells us how the energy gets from the front side of the film to the back side of the film. This is the proof, this next couple of slides is the proof that you can't do any scalar theory. So his theory was a vector theory, and the proof of that was we actually just showed the capacity of charging on 2 sides in the direction of the electric field. If I go back a couple of slides. So the electric field direction is this way in all 3 calculations. So let's look at the angle of incidence. To do this, Quanji limited his measured range just as a matter of time because he wanted to measure a lot of angles. He did this before I caught him at it, so that's the data that we have. And it's just simple. We come with light on the surface, and then we rotate it about an axis through the plane of the film. So we change the incident angle. We're always looking in zero order of diffraction. We haven't been able to measure in the infrared the energy in the various higher orders of diffraction. And so the outgoing wave is parallel to the incoming wave. So we just rotate the sample in the beam and measure the transmission. We have 2 polarizations, P and S. P is parallel, S is perpendicular. English is annoying in that both parallel and perpendicular start with a P, and so I can never remember until I remember that S is German for perpendicular. So perpendicular means, this is also confusing, the electric field is always parallel to the surface because it's the plane of incidence that is perpendicular to the E is perpendicular to the plane containing the incident beam and the outgoing beam. And that means it's always parallel. For parallel polarization, E has both perpendicular and parallel components. But H is not so important. And then the surface plasmons then would have opposite polarization. We should only see the surface plasmons for one of these. Okay. So here's what the transmission looks like as we rotate it. Let's do S first. That's E always in the plane of the film. the light's coming through as we rotate around a vertical axis, and we go out from 0 to 20 degrees. He had to limit the acceptance angle of the spectrometer to do this, and so the signal to noise went down a little bit. But you see basically a washing out of this. The diffraction minimum moves to shorter wavelengths because alpha, sine alpha, has to be included in the diffraction equation. Not much happens. P polarized is amazing. You've got one peak that moves to long wavelengths, one peak that moves to short wavelengths, the same for dips, so it's a very complicated. So just rotating the plane of polarization at a given incident angle, we get completely different spectrum. So I stopped reading papers that were scalar diffraction papers when we got this data. The angle dependence for S polarization for the peaks is following this curve. They scale slowly on this scale because he's got a fairly wide range. Here's the one that you saw moving the most. The theory predicts the blue curve, and the red is the experiment. This is not very good agreement, just like the peak locations at normal incidents didn't work very well. This is the surface plasmon polariton calculation. For P polarization, both theory and observation do predict one mode scan up and one mode scans down, but the location is not in agreement with the experiment. He's picked out the order that he's looking at. For peaks, doesn't work. Dips, that's just diffraction equation. Lambda times an order is grading constant sine alpha plus sine beta, and that works very well. So the angle dependence, S and P are very different, so a vector theory is clearly needed, and we have quantitative disagreement with the most popular theory for this. So let me turn to a third subject, bullseye structures. What I mean by a bullseye structure is a hole with some sort of corrugated pattern, still in metal films, but a single hole with some pattern of metal oscillations around it. It has a subwavelength hole in the center, and they also show high transmission. And what was more important when it was first observed is they show beaming. So the light comes out more parallel to the incident direction than you would think for this subwavelength hole. So this, again, was Ebbesen. Lezek was the first author, 2002. So they made a hole. They put a pattern around it. This is a cross-section, so the film gets alternately thicker, thinner, thicker, thinner as you come in. And they measured a fairly large transmission. They give arbitrary units, and I think this is actually percent, but it's not bad. And at a wavelength which corresponds to the grading constant, but what they really was interesting, they observed most of the light coming out in the forward direction, even though the size of the hole is only about a quarter of the wavelength of light or less. So you'd expect to get diffraction into all angles passing through this narrow slit or narrow hole. So that was interesting. So we made some of these. The main trick that we used was we had a focused ion beam so we could drill a hole through the center. And the FIB machine allows you to find the center first. That's important because you make the corrugations by sort of standard photoresist and E-beam lithography, and then you take it to the FIB and you drill a hole. And we measured, and what we one thing we did was we varied the hole. So we started out with zero hole, and then we drilled the hole progressively bigger and bigger and measured the transmission. So let's take a look at that. This is just, we also made holes without corrugations. So let's just take a picture first. This is the one where the hole had been drilled out pretty big in a high-quality 100x optical microscope, and then this is the center of some image from that. And we're shining white light from the bottom. And you see blue around it. This is the silver transmission. It goes up in the blue. I showed you a peak in the ultraviolet, but it's significant in the blue. You get significant yellow-orange transmission from the whole pattern, and then you get some white light through the hole. And that was interesting because the whole pattern seems to light up. And I have no explanation for this. It's got to be a diffraction effect associated with the yellow light being about the constant separating these slits and so forth, these grooves. And we have light incident over the whole surface, but this is metal, and it gets through and lights up the whole thing. So the observation is that the entire pattern lights up. And so this picture that the Lezek paper shows is not right. It is a small angle, but the light is coming from the whole surface. The whole is brighter than the yellow, but the yellow is a lot more area, and so most of the energy is emitted from the whole surface. And so this is large compared to the wavelength, if this hole is small compared to the wavelength. And so it's not a surprise that it doesn't diffract the light into large solid angles. We saw scaling. We didn't make too many. But this peak transmission, it has a wavelength dependence, and the smallest bullseye headed at the shortest wavelength, and the largest bullseye headed at larger wavelengths, and we didn't have much light beyond 23,000 nanometers. But basically the spacing of these rings determines where this peak is. Let's look at the effect of the hole. In fact, the hole is detrimental to the performance of the device. So we start out with just the ring pattern, and we measure the transmission. This is this black curve. We've got a fairly narrow peak, and it's centered up at the constant associated with this grooves. And then we drill a half micron hole, and the light goes down and it broadens. And then a 2 micron is green, and then 4 is blue, and then 8 is purple. And by the time we get to 16 microns, we're starting to have the hole win, and the power is coming back up. But the resonance is pretty well shot by them. So if you want to make one of these patterns to control light, you should not bother to put a hole in it. And what's happening is the light coming through the hole on this resonance frequency, it's pretty broad band, but it's interfering destructively with the light from the rings, from the pattern. And so we can even figure the phase out. So we have two beams, the ring and the hole, because we measured a bare hole. And we can add these up to get the combination just according to two-beam interferometer, and we get a phase difference. It's just I1 plus I2 plus 2 times the square root of I1, I2. It's the fields, cosine of the phase difference, and the phase is 2 pi over 3. Why it's 2 pi over 3, I don't know. But it's a nice round number anyway. Okay, imaging. People who do X-ray optics already know all I'm going to tell you about photon sieves and diffractive imaging. But this picture, which I sent up as the advertisement for the talk, was taken outside my office on a day much like today in Florida, and shows a palm tree. And it was taken by a little metal film, 100 nanometers thick, 3 millimeters in diameter. I'll tell you why in a minute. The holes are arranged to make an effective 50-meter focal length lens. And then there was just a digital SLR behind it, no other glass or anything. And I kind of like this picture. It's not real sharp, but you can see fairly fine details in the fronds. It's kind of a dreamy, hazy, impressionist style to the photograph. So this is called a photon sieve. And it's similar completely optically to the Fresnel zone plate. So let's say a little bit about a Fresnel zone plate. That's a set of rings, opaque, transparent. You can make phase wave plates, zone plates as well, where you just shift the phase. Each ring diffracts light, some of the light striking it. And n lambda is d sine theta. So the smaller the grating, the bigger the lambda's fixed, so we make d smaller, make theta bigger, and you can make all the rays come to a focus in first order. There's a second focus for second order, third focus, and so forth. And so to get high resolution, you actually have to make the outer rays comparable to a wavelength, but people who want to image X-rays often use this because it's a freestanding metal films made because there aren't very many good mirrors. for X-ray regions. Okay, so here's the formula. The focal length is the outer diameter, the spacing of the outermost zone divided by the wavelength. So it's a highly chromatic lens. Its focal length is linear and 1 over the wavelength. Canon actually are putting diffractive optics in some of their high-quality lenses because this dispersion is the opposite for some of the glass they use. So they actually use diffractive optics plus glass to make a lens which has no color dispersion or less color dispersion. They're very expensive, but they're lightweight compared to the all-glass equivalents. The photon sieve is just a slightly variation on that. And the reason you do the photon sieve is actually to improve the quality of the image. So this is a photon sieve generated by a colleague of ours. I first saw this was in a Nature paper in 2001, but this was a ITC in North Carolina had a person who could generate. This is a specific choice of holes. So what you do is you make the hole size equivalent to what you would have in the zone plate. So you have big holes near the center, small holes out near the edge. And then you adjust the density of holes in order to give an apodization to the diffraction pattern or the focusing pattern. Remember that a lens more or less takes a Fourier transform, and if you cut things off sharply, like you do with a zone plate, then you get a central peak, but you get a set of feet behind it. And you can actually use the photon sieve to narrow up the central peak. You do that by diminishing the number of holes in the center, and to get rid of the feet by tapering off the density of holes out near the edge. So the resolution is better and the contrast is better than the zone plate. We didn't make them quite this fancy. Here's ours. So here's an unapodized one. Just a ring of holes of wider and then progressively narrower and narrower diameters until you get out to the edge. This one is apodized. You start here and you start tapering off the density of holes in some nice form. It has a Fourier transform, a 2D Fourier transform of the shape you want. And here's the apodized shape. Here's the unapodized one in terms of the light intensity. It's interesting that even though you've reduced the number of holes out here, you think there might be less light, the apodized one is actually a little brighter on center, and it's narrower and doesn't have this structure. If you take a picture with an unapodized or with the zone plate, it looks much harsher than the picture with the apodized photon sieve. Here's an actual lens made by E-beam lithography. There are many, many holes, and the little electron beam had to go sit there over and over again, but they did a nice job. The scale here is 200 microns, 2/10 of a millimeter. So this is a little under 2/10 of a millimeter on the center. This is one with a dark center. You can, of course, replace the holes with metal and the metal with holes and get slightly different patterns. So let's take a look at a picture. Okay, this is a picture of the entire photon sieve out to the edge. You can see the apodization start pretty far out. This is the new physics building in Gainesville. And again, it sort of has that dreamy look to it. But if you look closely at it, you might notice something. Here's some a leaf that's pretty close to the lens, and it's sharp. And here's a tree, which is probably 300 meters away. And you can see detail in the branches. And you also can see, say, around this very bright concrete ledge, that there's some hazing around it, or there's a ghost image that's larger. And that seems to be the tendency of these things when you take pictures with them. I can improve the resolution since the lens is designed for a single wavelength. It was designed for the green. So we'll look at the green channel and filter. And now you can see quite a bit of detail back here, and you still see detail there. So the photon sieve apparently has a greater depth of field than a corresponding lens. And we actually check that. That's probably going to end the talk. To compare the depths of field. So we're going to compare a 50 millimeter photon sieve. The weight is less than a gram. This is the selling point if you're trying to sell this to an agency. And it costs very little to make if you have access to lithography, versus a decent Canon lens weighs 400 grams. And they're both set to 3-millimeter aperture, so I didn't cheat on this depth of field thing by opening the lens up and destroying the depth of field. So they're both essentially the same F number, F16. So let's see, I did a little bit of work in Photoshop for the sieves. Color, and I did one level of unsharp mask. My colleagues at Raytheon said they can nuke it, as they say, which means a non-uniform correction imaging, and they could take it, make it look almost perfect. But that's all I did. So here is Kwanji's finger. It's the first finger. with the Canon lens and with the photon sieve. And you can see that overall, the distant stuff is a lot better with the lens, but the trees have a fair amount of detail in them, and his finger, you can see the joint on his finger, and this is completely out of focus. And so we have, again, sort of another proof of better depth of field. Let's actually try to quantize this. So we used a little digital CCD called the WinCam. It says the only way, it's not a bad device, except it uses an interface which no longer is available on modern computers, but aside from that. We imaged at a certain wavelength, the wavelength for which the sieve was optimized, a very small hole onto the WinCam, and then it shows the brightness. This is a 50-millimeter lens. This is a scan through the center. It's got a fairly strong peak, and it's got blue means very little intensity, so not much scattering in the 50-millimeter lens. Here's the photon sieve. It has a fairly high plateau. That's comparable to that ghost image around the white concrete that was in the side of the physics building, but it's still got a fairly narrow peak. Let's compare these directly. This is the lens on when it's imaged properly on the CCD. Here's the photon sieve, and it's got this plateau, which is again my image analysis people that the company we were working with says that's not a problem. As you go out of focus, the lens produces a much broader image with structure at this wavelength because it's an out-of-focus airy spot. And the sieve, it broadens a bit when we go from 50 millimeters away to 52.3 millimeters away, but basically holds up a lot better in the out-of-focus image. And the out-of-focus image, of course, is the same thing as the depth of field because the focal plane is somewhere in the field of view, but not over the whole range. So there's the comparison of in focus. The resolution in the lens is better, but not a lot better. But the background in the photon sieve is much worse, of course. The photon sieve doesn't transmit as much. On peak, we're losing light because it's got light passing through holes in metal where there's some absorption. The glass, of course, is pretty high-quality glass. So my conclusions on the imaging is if you want to do art, a photon sieve is really nice. There was a company called Pinhole Images, which would sell you photon sieves and zone plates and pinholes in just black plastic, probably film, actually. But they seem to be out of business. And we got some and got some pictures with theirs as well. Some of the flare probably is because we haven't blackened the back surface, and the CCD of the camera sadly reflects more than it should. Some of that comes back and hits the metal, shiny metal, and comes right back to the CCD. CF has better depth of field. Okay, so I've told you sort of four stories, one of which was a miserable failure, except that we learned an unexpected phase relation. We looked at the enhanced transmission by periodic arrays, corrugated metal structures, imaging. One point about the photon sieve is, since it's a metal film with holes in it, you can make it for any wavelength you want. And so the X-ray people make it a lot. The infrared or terahertz people probably ought to think about these too, because if you want to make a lens for 100 micron wavelength or 200 micron wavelength way out in the far infrared, you're stuck using some awful TPX or silicon, which weighs a ton, and the photon sieve would be relatively cheap, because in that case you could make it almost with a machining device and a drill press, and so just drilling holes in metals. We made that argument to an agency and it wasn't successful, but something one should look for. And I guess if I take a bottom line away, geometry, Bragg's law, governs the performance of diffractive optics. That's no surprise, but it's certainly true. So thank you very much for your attention.